El Coquí Espectacular!
A world premiere superhero play, El Coquí Espectacular and the Bottle of Doom runs through February 4th at Two River Theater in Red Bank. And one of the stars of the show joins us on the WBGO Journal. Gabriel Hernandez plays the villain El Chupacabra, as well as Junior. I sat down with a Hoboken resident to talk about this exciting new play set in Sunset Park, Brooklyn.
The story is about a young Puerto Rican comic book artist, struggling kid. He's a couple years out of college, and he's living back at home with his mom. And he's feeling a little bit disillusioned. He's in between jobs. He just quit his job because he was pitching comic book ideas that the guys didn't go for because they were too spicky, quote unquote. And so he's feeling disempowered, and he creates this Puerto Rican, this New Yorican comic book hero named El Coquí Espectacular. Just at home, at his drafting desk, he draws up this guy. And then, because he's that much of a nerd and a freak, he starts dressing up as him. Not even with the intent of fighting crime or being a vigilante, but just to get more in the character and just for inspiration's sake. Of course, this is New York City. It goes viral. He starts getting attention for it, gets in a couple of fights that he wasn't looking for. It all proceeds from there. His family gets involved. His brother, meanwhile, is working for a soda company, and he's trying to balance his own identity as a Puerto Rican guy with these kind of questionable advertising strategies that he's being asked to sign off on as the sort of token Hispanic copywriter in the room. So the central relationship in the show is these two young men and how they sort of navigate their senses of Puerto Rican identity, feeling less than, feeling not quite enough in that regard.
And the company is where we get the other part of the show in the Bottle of Doom, right?
Exactly right, yeah, yeah. The sort of Voltage is the name of the soda brand. And you know, without giving too much away, yeah, that is where the Bottle of Doom comes from.
So take us into your character, because The main characters, including you, are really based on Puerto Rican legends. For those who aren't, you know, familiar, El Coquí is a tree frog that is very, you know, that everybody who goes to Puerto Rico, you can't not, you know, experience
no,
that.
That's...
But tell us about your character a little bit more.
So the Chupacabra, I, as a Puerto Rican kid growing up, the Chupacabra for me was a half boogeyman, half joke. And the older I got, the more of a joke it was. But when you're a little bit younger, you know, you definitely... There's a spooky element to it, and it's a mythical beast that is responsible for dead or disappeared livestock in the Caribbean. I don't think just in Puerto Rico. I have Mexican and Dominican friends who, you know, the Chupacabra was also a figure in their households. I never pictured what it looked like. Our costume designer, she came up with this sort of like gruesome lizard beast, which is awesome. I didn't know if it was a mammal or what. I guess it's whatever you make of it. But in this show in particular, the Chupacabra exists mostly within Alex's own head as a sort of haunting creature that gives voice to all of his deepest insecurities, all of his fears, all of his self-loathing. And the other part that I play, Junior, is Alex's childhood bully. And there's a reason why those two parts are designed to be played by the same actor, because he has sort of given Junior's voice to this phantom who's there at every turn reminding him that he's not enough or that he's unworthy or that he's falling short somehow.
And thank goodness for that too, because we want to see Gabriel Hernandez's face, so we don't just want to see you, you know, in that costume.
Yeah, it's funny, I didn't realize at first that it was going to be mask work. I'm talking about the very beginning, you know, when I first auditioned for the role. And there was maybe like a split second of disappointment when I did realize that most of the time I would be obscured. I don't know why, maybe just from like a narcissist perspective or something. but then once I got used to it, it's thrilling. This is my first time doing mask work, and there's something really cool about it. It's almost safer in some ways. Being on stage is super vulnerable, and the mask is kind of insulating, and I can really just focus on what I'm doing with my voice and my body, and it's kind of this cloak, you know, the fact that the audience can't see me, there's something cool about it. I've enjoyed it.
you become a superhero at home? I mean, even though you're like the villain here, but you're one of those creatures in a comic book now. Does that stay with you at all now?
I mean, a little bit. It's definitely been a thrilling ride. You know, there's some moments. I mean, this is true just anytime you're lucky enough to get paid to do something you would do for free. Shh, don't tell anyone. There's a euphoric feeling, but especially with this piece. I mean, I'm 32 years old. 20 years ago, I was doing the same stuff in my backyard with my little brother, and now I'm doing it for a living. You know, just pretending to be some creature and using my imagination and figuring out how this beast would move or sound. You know, how to give life to, you know, to give voice to something made up. You know, that's I've been doing that for a long time. You know, it is pretty thrilling to be able to do it. You know, with this beautiful play.
We're at Two River Theater, where the play El Coqui Espectacular and the Bottle of Doom, written by Matt Borbo and directed by Jose Zayas, is being performed, and one of the stars of the show, Gabriel Hernandez, is joining us. Are you excited that this play is set in New York?
Yeah, I am. It's cool. I mean, I'm from Jersey, I'm from Hoboken, so almost New York. I went to high school in Manhattan, though, and I lived in Brooklyn for a couple of years. I lived in Bushwick, so I'm a bridge and tunnel kid. I'm a Jersey boy, but New York City was always felt like home too. And it's really cool and hilarious to imagine this story playing out in like modern Sunset Park with this dude like running around in his pajamas, going from roof to roof, and people taking to Twitter to express their amazement or confusion or horror or whatever else, and the Puerto Rican Day Parade, which I grew up going to, serving as sort of like the fulcrum of the piece, and you know where the climax of the story takes place, you know, and yeah, the Puerto Rican Day Parade is amazing, and also like it's a mess every year, so it was a worthy setting for sure to have this this sort of battle royale and this figure looming over the piece.
You have a number of talents, you know, voiceover stuff you do. You can move your body, I understand. You do, you know, burlesque kind of activity. So you're blessed with all that kind of ability. How do you use that to your advantage with both of your characters in this?
I think that just the rawness of both roles and the physicality that they demand. It's funny because I'm stiff. You know, I've never thought of myself. I'm not trained as a dancer. I'm a bad dancer. I like dancing. It's fun, but it's not. You know, I'm not like some of the guys that I dance with are beautiful, beautiful dancers. They, you know, they're tap dancers and they're you know, they've studied ballet and jazz for years. And I always was an athlete who just had sort of like a kind of a jerky, spastic kind of weird physicality and when I'm lucky enough to find the right role that where I don't have to hide what my body wants to do, that's a win. that's gold. And in this particular show, with all the comic book fights and the way that this beast is sort of stooped over or crawling or you know oozing in and out of the stage, bringing that sort of weird, unique animal physicality. That's where I feel like I'm most comfortable because I just get to be a little weird and not even necessarily have a plan all of the time, but just get freaky with it.
Now the story was written by Matt Borbo, who was basically a comic book collector himself when he was growing up in New York. So this is all things that are coming out of his head. People love comic books these days, and you know with the whole Marvel series and DC Comics. There's so many movies. So I would imagine that this plays right into the fact that people like to have superhero kind of shows, and this kind of feeds into it, but with a little different twist this time.
Yeah. I think, yeah, I mean, it really does plug into, I mean, the way that superhero movies in particular have sort of taken off over the last decade and change, it's wild. I don't know what that says about society in terms of who the impulse to create, I don't know what, vigilantes or sort of escapism to imagine us needing to be saved or the world being threatened or whatever. Some of that, I guess, reflects some of people's real life fears. What Matt did so brilliantly with this piece is that he's woven in these identity questions and superimposed a superhero story, or really a story about storytelling, more so than an actual superhero story, but on top of this really complicated, fraught question of who are we, what about those of us who reside in between identities, the hyphen, the, you know, the third generation Latinos, the guys who, the kids who don't even really speak Spanish that well, and I'm one of those, and are identified with a particular culture, or a particular part of the world, and that means something to them, but they can't necessarily claim it as their own, but they're not part of necessarily the culture of power in this country either. So they really find that in-betweenness, it's real and it's tricky and it's complicated. And Matt, the way that he has sort of presented that story, that sort of identity story for Alex as this writer who's trying to tell this story that maybe he doesn't even feel equipped enough to tell. You know, at one point he has created this cartoon, this comic book character that's super stereotypical. It's, you know, he gets all the stuff from random Puerto Rican powers, Taino this and Orisha's that, and this kid's from Brooklyn, you know. So it's like, why is he going so hard towards that Puerto Ricanness? Well, that, you know, he's been forced into that direction and then forced away from it by being told he's not this or he's not that, you know. And I that resonates with my own past a lot. So that as a hero story too. I mean, they really work beautifully as parallels.
Our listeners already can get a sense of the intelligence and the way with words that Gabriel has. With 2 degrees from Yale University, how do you end up being a villain in a comic book play?
that's a great question. You know, I it's a long answer. I'll give you the short version. I think when I first came out of Yale, if I had been honest with myself, the thing that I would have wanted to pursue most would have been to come to New York and try my hand at performance of some kind and start auditioning for stuff. And I was scared. I was scared, and I didn't even really know where to begin. And I also really loved kids, and I'd been working with kids for many summers at that point in a summer theater camp in my hometown called Extravaganza. My parents are both educators. So that felt like a safer path for me that wasn't settling because I loved it too. So going towards education, I stayed on. I got a master's in education at Yale and taught in the New Haven public school system for a couple of years. And then made my way back to New York, back to Hoboken, and continued teaching, and that felt like my path. And I was doing some theater on the side, doing some community stuff, you know. So I still felt like I was flexing those muscles. And the work that I was doing with kids was mostly theater. It started out as being a social studies teacher, but then I transitioned into the theater classroom, doing some arts education stuff after school. So it felt like I'd found the right combination of my two biggest passions. Working with young people and performance. But then when I got fired for basically starting a race war at the school I was teaching at, my alma mater of all places, in my middle school alma mater, I was like, you know what? This is an opportunity. This is 2.5 years ago. I was like, this is an opportunity to take a risk and throw myself into the performing arts community and just see what happens. And, you know, I nothing to lose. If I don't get work, I have a foundation to fall back on, and I can continue to be an educator in the future. But let me at least take a stab at the actor life. And it's been a good run so far. It's been a good couple of years.
Do you want to give us any more details about the incident?
Oh, about at the school? I mean, the short of it is that the school was in kind of at an institutional crossroads. It's a small private school. Whose founder was still the principal some 30-something years later. And it was high time for a transition. And there were just like a number of different conflicts happening. The parents were involved. The board was involved. It was sort of a treacherous it was a war zone, you know. Yeah, as far as private schools can be war zones, you know, that's a sort of foolish language to use. But you know, there were just a bunch of different issues. And among them, you know, just some racial conversations in terms of how our students of color felt marginalized at points and trying to raise awareness to the faculty. And that was met with a lot of tension. And, you know, that's an old story. But, you know, it was wild. It was painful. It was a tough year. I was there for 3 years full time, but I'd been working there for several years before that in a sort of part time after school or during summers capacity. But yeah, that one summer, nine teachers left out of like 30. It's a small school, so it was, you know, major turnover. So the school was ready for major change, and so I wound up getting caught in the crosshairs of that a little bit. But I don't regret any of it. Actually, it wound up opening this door for me personally, and it was an important experience for me, just in terms of how I continue to navigate these conversations, you know, conversations about race and power and the political sort of ramifications of being outspoken and a button pusher and impolitic sometimes, you know. So it wound up being, and also I had my mom in the foxhole with me. Me and my mom were colleagues, and that was a trip, you know. So that was a cool experience to have.
We're speaking with Gabriel Hernandez, one of the stars of the world premiere superhero play, El Coquille Espectacular and the Bottle of Doom, here at Two River Theater. You know, not just an education at Yale University, but a life partner. You
Indeed.
Met your wife, Rachel,
yes.
At Yale University. Take us into how that all developed.
It was cool. So she was a freshman when I was a junior. And we started out just as friends. I was actually, I had a girlfriend when I first met Rachel. And then when my girlfriend and I broke up, because I cheated on her in Paris, as you know, as all stupid, you know, college boys do, I guess, I sought out my new friend Rachel's singing voice. She has a beautiful voice. She was a singer, still a singer. I sought out her voice in a rap love song that I was going to make to get my ex girlfriend back. I wrote this rap song. I had Rachel sing the chorus. And, you know, I sent it to my ex. It didn't work. but in that process, Rachel and I got closer and our friendship solidified. We continued to be friends for another many months after that before we started moving more in the direction of being romantically involved. So it was cool. It was cool to have that as a foundation, to have someone who really, really knew me as a collaborator, as a homie. And then, you know, that wound up serving as a really beautiful foundation for us. And, you know, we share a ton of friends and a ton of interests. And, you know, we've collaborated in many different capacities. We make music together.
You're a 90s hip-hop guy.
I am indeed, yeah. So when we, you know, get in the booth, you know, that's the aesthetic that we try to emulate. You know, those are our biggest musical inspirations.
So let me put you on the spot. Give us a little bit of 90s hip-hop style explaining your character.
Explaining my character? Let me see. My words are fervidly furthering my prowess to dominance. Absurdly perfectly constructed rhymes are not quite commonplace. I'm like Jesus, minus the spiritual, in that I'm sticking to hypocrites with my lyrical miracles.
I was right on the spot there. That was pretty darn good, Gabriel. And also, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't also mention a very special moment happened for you less than a year ago, I understand, with the birth of your son.
Yeah, my little freak, my little boy. I just hung out with him the last couple of days. I've been an absentee father the last few weeks or so. But yeah, we have a son. His name is Elias, depending on what language you're speaking to him in. And yeah, he's about to be 8 months old. I almost wish he was a little bit older so he could be in the audience for this show, you know. I feel like this show would be such a fun thing to share with, you know, but hopefully I'll have other opportunities in the future to wear an insane costume, you know, when he's a little boy who can actually perceive things outside of, you know, a foot in front of his face as he's crawling across the floor like a little beast that he is. Yeah.
Well, you're probably going to have the video of this, too, at some point. It's interesting because my daughter is 25 years old, and I used to have a character. This was really before the Chechen rebels were in the news, and okay. He was called the Chechen, and he lived and experienced all kinds of things, and I took him through all kinds of experiences. So whatever season we were in, if it was Halloween, you know, the Chechen was half man, half beast. I see maybe a whole thing with your character in this show becoming maybe some sort of like a tale that you could, you know, take your son through, and he could learn tradition and also learn about, you know, El Coqui and also your character, you know, through experiencing maybe when you watch the show or even as he grows up, you know, bedtime stories. What do you think about that?
That's dope. I love that idea. I think that would be a a real trip. And then I can keep wearing the costume, which I'm wed to and I'm totally obsessed with.
We're speaking with the man who plays El Chupacabra and Junior in the new world premiere play El Coqui Espectacular and the Bottle of Doom, running through February 4th at Two River Theater, directed by Jose Zayas.
Oh, it's been a dream working with Jose. He's a brilliant theater artist. It's cool watching him in his partnership with Matt, tinkering with a still new piece of theater, and in his role as sort of mechanic and sounding board, tweaking language and making cuts and trying to get to the core of a scene, to get to the truth of a moment. And then it's been awesome being directed by him and hearing the way he shares his vision. He's an actor's director. I mean, he really is. He's so cool and so smart. It's been a joy.
For most people, just being able to play one role in a play or a musical is a challenge. But I always wonder when people have, and this has been, you know, with plays are written nowadays more than ever, I think, to have multiple roles,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Because of, you know, just trying to take the advantage of a less amount of people, right, than mm-hmm. to be involved in a cast. How difficult is it to have two roles in a show?
It has its challenges. It's a cool opportunity, and obviously it depends on the show and it depends on what the roles are. But especially in this one, where the two roles are different, but also in many ways two sides of the same coin, and they're sort of speaking to each other across time. You know, with Junior living mostly, I mean, Junior's on stage for a couple of key moments. But most of the time he really is this specter from Alex's youth that's just continuing to haunt him as the voice that told him he wasn't, that called him Puerto Rican, that said that he wasn't enough, that he wasn't authentic, that he wasn't legit. So being able to play the two parts where one of them is a flesh and blood human who we eventually do meet, and the other one is more sort of allegorical or more. More in this guy's head, that actually I think wound up being making it a little easier than if it's just you're playing two roles and they're two men and they have totally different personalities and you got to figure out how these two human beings move through space so you're keeping it interesting and actually making them each a unique character. This one was. I was positioned well to be able to have one be a part of the other while making it really clear physically when the differences are, and also the fact that my face is obscured while playing Chupacabra. You know, that it's pretty helpful for me. You know, I didn't have to. It's not an acting masterclass by by any stretch. You know, in terms of wearing multiple hats or something. You know, I got hooked up. It lends itself perfectly. To one actor being able to portray the two roles and going one into the other and back.
Obviously, the audiences are enjoying this, but do you feel that maybe if you have Latin descent that you are going to enjoy this maybe even more?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of special things that'll resonate for you know, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Hispanic, et cetera, audience members. In terms of just, you know, things about the Puerto Rican family and this relationship between these two boys and their mom and you know, certain Spanish phrases that are peppered throughout and just dynamics that we as Latinos are, you know, for the most part familiar with, There's little things for us, definitely. But I also do think it really is universally enjoyable, and I think anybody could walk into that theater with no knowledge of Brooklyn or the comic book universe or what it means to be New Yorkian or not New Yorkian. I think anybody could sit down and be like, "Oh, cool story," and you know, what an interesting combo of factors for play to be exploring and look at these beautiful relationships. You know, I think Matt did a really brilliant job of writing a show that feels intimate and feels like an inside sort of story that we could own about representation and about, you know, exploration and identity, but that also does have a bunch of universal truths in there. You know, not everyone in the audience will know what it's like to not feel Puerto Rican enough, but certainly they'll know what it's like to have not thought they were enough of something, or to feel fraudulent in some aspect, or to explore that relationship across a couple of decades with a family member going through the same thing. You know, there's sort of like zoom in, zoom out, you know, moments just throughout that I think gives it a universal appeal.
Are there enough Latino roles in the entertainment world right now for mainstream, or is this help create some roles that maybe we're not seeing?
I think we're getting better. I think that, you know, each year we're carving out more space. I don't think we're where we want to be in terms of representation for any, you know, sort of marginalized groups, people of color, women, queer people. I think there's still work to be done. Certainly, I have a mentor of mine, Jorge Merced, who is an artistic director at Pregones Theater in the Bronx. He was telling me a story a couple of years ago about the headshots that he used to get sent to him, more in the 90s, maybe like late 80s, 90s, and he would get these headshots from young Latino male actors who wanted to work at the theater, and they'd send these headshots in, and the headshots would have these young men posing with a gun, smoking a marijuana cigarette, looking like the most sort of cartoonishly thugged out prisoners like ever. And it was shocking, but at first, then when you think about it, what kind of roles were available? They were dressing for the part. That's what you're told to do for auditions, right? You dress for the part. So in terms of the first TV roles available for Latino men in particular, that's what he was talking about in this case. That's what it was, is gangbangers and drug dealers and convicts and thugs. I think we've come a long way. I don't feel the same pressures necessarily to make my image exclusively threatening and hard and streetwise or something. It doesn't hurt to have that in your back pocket to be able to talk a certain way, and, you know, I got a bald head and my ears are pierced, so yeah, sure, I'll use it. You know, if you want me to play a thug, I'm trying to get that money. I'm trying to work, right? But it's refreshing that the landscape has widened enough that's not the only thing out there for us, you know, that we're starting to carve out some space where it's like, hey, we can just be people. We can play professors or nerds or lovers or whatever, you know, cat ladies. You know what I mean? Like, not everyone has to be like pregnant or a dropout or a junkie, you know? So it's just about sort of the different possibilities that everyone that should be able to see in front of them, you know, in terms of art reflecting life and vice versa. Think about how many Latinos you all know. Are they, you know, they're different, right?
With that being said, you have a young son.
Yeah.
And when he gets a little bit older, how important will be heritage to you to explain to him? As you mentioned, you know, you don't speak Spanish that well. Mm-hmm. You know, you speak English, and he probably will speak English even better than, you know, than a lot of his maybe friends from different parts.
Sure.
So is it important to instill the, you know, the heritage, but yet even though he's not from that area anymore?
Yeah, I think it is, just in terms of you know, stories matter, and lineage matters, and where we come from. You know, so me personally, I'm half Jewish, half Puerto Rican. My wife is, you know, a New England sort of Anglo Mayflower baby. You know, she's as like blue blooded as it gets ethnically, right? So this kid is Puerto Rican, we call him. And will Puerto Ricanness be central to his identity? Probably not. But it doesn't mean it doesn't have to have a role. It can't sort of be a piece of the puzzle. And I think that'll be increasingly common. You know, the sort of beige future of our sort of intermixing, right? Where people are like, oh yeah, I'm half this and I'm half that, or I'm three quarters this, or I'm one quarter this, one quarter that, and one quarter this and one quarter that. You know, and that's interesting. And the stories that we, you know, I'll give you an example of how he can carry some of this with him. My father-in-law, my wife's dad, is a genealogy nerd and a generous one, and he looks into all of our, you know, stories, and he uses ancestry.com, and he digs deep, and he makes family trees. He's the man. And he found my grandfather's census data. My grandfather, Samuel Hernandez, he was born in 1908 in Puerto Rico as a 2-year-old. He was accounted for in the census for the first time. In 1910 was the first time that Puerto Rico appeared on the U.S. Census. And his race, as determined by the census guy who went door to door, his race in 1910 was, now, mind you, the races available to that person checking off the people in the home or whatever were black, white, mulatto, Indian, Native American Indian, Chinese, Japanese, and other. Those were the 7 official races in the 1910 census. My grandfather's race was black, and then in parentheses, white. He had mulatto and other at his disposal. And throw a Native American, too, if you want. And my grandfather was black and then white in parentheses afterwards. What sense do we make of that? And it's and 100 plus years later, the Puerto Rican question remains as confounding any angle you look at it in terms of how the United States of America is to relate to this sort of colony or this territory, this commonwealth, this would-be 51st state or whatever. So whether my son feels super Latino or not, whether he's related to, you know, if he passes as what, you know, if he, however the society, he's going to have Hernandez is his last name, however he gets related to, he's going to have these stories from all four grandparents, and all 8 or all 16, whatever, great grandparents. He's going to, you know, and they all have kernels and all, they're all inform his experience, you know, as a kid growing up in the 20-teens and the 2020 coming of age in the 2020s or 2030s or whatever, that, you know, as the different as the world changes around him, you know, I think heritage matters because it can root him in the past that's still relevant today in many ways.
As we wrap this up, what has Gabriel Hernandez learned from playing this role? You know, you're a deep guy. I can tell you, you got some things going on in there. Has it changed you in any way?
I think that, yeah. I mean, I think that it, specifically giving voice to the bully. You know, not that that's like, I hope I wasn't a bully. I don't think I was a bully in real life, but you know, I can be kind of a crass, and I can sort of get after people sometimes or whatever. But in terms of this sort of specific personal, deep digging cruelty that this character is responsible for, in terms of just poking at this wound, at this festering scab and not letting it heal, and one that, you know, when I think about it, in real life I have way more in common with Alex than I do with Chupacabra. You know, at many different points I doubted my own, you know, partially being happy, but even if both my parents were Puerto Rican, when you grow up in Jersey or New York or wherever, you're told when you visit your family members in Puerto Rico that you're the gringo, you're the American one, right? Like you're the one that lives in Jersey. You're the one who Spanish is bootleg. You're the one who, you know, needs things translated or explained to him, right? You know, so much so that then you lean in all the way into that identity. So at my private school, that I went to, Friends Seminary in Manhattan, and I used to like drape Puerto Rican regalia. You know, I used to just cover myself in Puerto Rican flags. I used to announce the Puerto Rican Day Parade in like silent meeting. You know, I was like, that was the instinct that I had as like a 16-year-old. And I was like, oh, I have to like go so hard that no one doubts for one second how real I am, how authentic my Latinidad is, my Puerto Ricanness is. So being able to sort of torment our hero with these questions and push his buttons has, you know, it's reminded me of some of those, some of my own journey and some of those moments of real self-doubt and questions. You know, it's been interesting, you know, in terms of perspectival kind of shifts and you know, just seeing the, you know, the not the other side of, there's no other side, you know, but sort of the devil on the shoulder or whatever, giving voice to that has unearthed some of those feelings from my younger days and made me reflect on those. And you know, I think that's part of what's so successful about Matt's piece also is the way that he plumbs the depths of like adolescent and recently post adolescent insecurity around identity questions. It's powerful.
And this is your debut at Two River Theater, right?
It is indeed, yeah. And it's been glorious. This is a really gorgeous theater, and everyone who works here is so wonderful. It's been a treat. I don't want it to end.
I think the only thing I didn't get a chance to ask you is the other characters, the other people in the show, the actor who plays Alex and whatnot. Maybe just give us a real brief synopsis of who's in the show and your working relationship with them.
Oh, sure. So the role of Alex is played by Bradley James Tejeda. He is a recent Yale School of Drama graduate from Texas. He's a super talent. He's been a lot of fun to bully. And I definitely just bully him in real life now. That's I can't turn it off. His older brother Joe is played by Cesar P. Rosado. I don't know, I said it so American. Cesar, Don Cesar, we call him. Cesar Rosado, he's a New York actor, and he's a stud. He's been at it for a minute. He, you know, I think he's my age or so, a little bit older than Bradley. Bradley's a baby. Yeah, I don't have any scenes with him really, but watching him work has been awesome. He's a super talented professional, and he's been our stage our fight captain. So he's a shrewd one. You know, not everyone you wind up just getting forced into being stage fight captain sometimes, depending on the show you're in. And actually, I can't imagine doing it. I've never had to do it. But he has these insights. It's really awesome because we still have fight call every day for safety reasons, and we're still messing with the fights and making sure that we're doing it right. And you know, so to have his eyes in the house while we're warming up has been vital. The role of Patricia, the mom of the two boys, is played by Olivia Negron, who's bi-coastal. I think she's between Cali and New York now. And she's like the mama of the cast and the mama of those boys. She's absolutely wonderful. She's just such a breath of fresh air. She's an absolute sweetheart and just a force of nature on stage. Just a vet, you know, just getting to watch a career actor who's, you know, a few decades into a really dope career that's taken her all over the place. It's been cool to watch her process. And then the role of Jessica, who is the comic book images called her the sidekick, sort of like April O'Neil-y, sort of Mary Jane, is it the Spider-Man, you know, character. But I think a doper, more complicated, meatier version of those two. Where she is not just tagging along for the ride with Alex, but actually pushing him and being his conscience and keeping him honest and you know, she's got like a ferocity and an integrity about her that drives a lot of the show. And Flor de Lis, Perez, She says Perez. Perez in Spanish. Flor de Lis Perez is the actor who plays Jessica, and Flor is so incredible. She's an absolute monster of a performer and an absolute delight in rehearsal process. It feels like I'm in middle school when I'm hanging out with Flor. We just cut up and are beatboxing and freestyling and dancing and being silly. So yeah, it's been a super warm friendship solidifying vibe. You know, it's a small cast. There's only five of us, and that can be dangerous if the people don't get along. Right, it's intimate. We spend a lot of time together, and we really do love each other. It's been a good ride.
As people leave Two River Theater, what do you want them to be talking about in the car driving home?
That's a great question. I hope they're talking about. I hope they can't decide whether to talk about the amazing visuals and how big and fun it was, and or how intense and sweet and heartbreaking it was. And I hope they just keep interrupting each other and themselves to remark on the awesome sound effects and the incredible set and the incredible scenic design, or the really cool costumes and these really beautiful fleshed out relationships, you know, between these characters, because the show really does have it all, and it's fast, you know, so we throw a lot at you, and it's a quick, no intermission, 90-minute show, and I hope people are just staggering out, you know, just feeling like, wow, that was crazy. I don't even know where to begin in terms of recapping or processing, because it was, you know, because it was overwhelming in a good way.
I certainly look forward to seeing the show, and I'm sure many people do now too. After meeting one of the stars of the show, Gabriel Hernandez, thanks so much for joining us on the WBGO Journal. Continued success to you, and wonderful times with your wife and your new son, and maybe those storytelling days are just ahead for Gabriel Hernandez.
Hey, thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it. It's been an absolute pleasure.